0.5 gigabytes. So when people say ongoing investigations, could it prevent some documents from being released? Maxwell, could it prevent some documents from being released? Maybe, but we're talking about 5%. Where are the other 95% of the documents? Where are the documents the three federal judges have ordered released without significant redaction? So the concern here is, what are they hiding and who are they protecting?
So President Trump has provided over almost a monolithic Republican Party, but now there are cracks. And I think it very much started with the Epstein files, right? You have Congress members Nancy Mace, Marjorie Taylor Greene, and others who left the Republican Party to join the Democrats, I mean, just on this vote. Now more than a tenth of the current Congress has indicated they will not return to their seats after the midterms. We're talking about something like well over 40 senators and Congress members, and the majority of them are Republican. The significance of this?
Donald Trump is finally losing his MAGA base. This is the one issue, the Epstein files, where the MAGA base disapproves overwhelmingly of Donald Trump. And it goes to the question, whose side are you on? Are you on the side of these rich and powerful men who abused young girls have elite impunity? Or are you going to stand with abandoned young girls and the working class? And what the Republicans are starting to see is that Trump has betrayed his own base, that he's become part of the swamp that he railed against. And so you now see, after this discharge petition, there's suddenly tons of discharge petitions in the Congress on all sorts of topics. People are willing to defy Speaker Johnson. They're willing to defy Donald Trump. Many are thinking about a post-Trump future. If they have aspirations of a political career for the next 10 years, they're trying to position for their own careers and less about protecting Donald Trump.
The significance of Elise Stefanik not only pulling out of the New York Republican, the New York governor's race, but now ending her congressional career, at least for the moment.
Well, I took some satisfaction because she was so over the top in the way she's gone after universities in this country. And she has been pandering to the worst elements of Trump's base. And yet, you know, now she's seeing the writing on the wall. She was not going anywhere in the New York governor's race. And she sees that they're going to lose the House majority in 2026.
So very quickly, going through a few other issues, and many do actually see them linked to Epstein, one after another, dramatic events of the Trump administration, perhaps to pull attention away, and of course, Venezuela. One bombing after another that the Pentagon can't quickly enough release video, except when it comes to the second video of the September 2nd bombing, showing the two men who survived the first bombing. They will not release this at this point. And today, Hegseth and President Trump are expected to hold some kind of meeting announcement at Mar-a-Lago at 4:30 in the afternoon. What about the U.S. pursuing these oil tankers near Venezuela? The one that's Chinese-owned Panamanian flag vessel named Centuries was not under U.S. sanction. Is he trying to provoke a war with Venezuela?
Yes, it's of deep concern to me. He is basically trying to have a regime change war on Maduro, trying to put pressure on Maduro to step aside. The risk of having an incident that leads to war has increased. We have more destroyers in the region, in the Caribbean. We are striking boats. We have Marines in Puerto Rico. We have Marines off the on the coast of Florida. And I, being on the Armed Services Committee, have seen in a classified setting the second video. Some of us have said, release it. Release it for the American public. But I have two concerns. First, why are we going into a regime change war when the president promised no endless wars? And second, why is the American government, in my name, in your name, killing people on these boats without a clear standard of what they have done that justifies the death?
So how does Congress stop this?
We tried to pass a war powers resolution, McGovern, me, Massey, and we lost by a single vote. And so we need to get more Republicans and two Democrats convinced that that we have to stop another regime change war. We've got to build that to support in the Congress.
You're here in New York, Zoran Land. He is going to become mayor on January 1st, midnight of New Year's Eve. On the day he met President Trump at the White House, when President Trump said he's not a jihadist. Of course, that was actually simply an attack on Elise Stefanik, who always referred to Zoran Mamdani as a jihadist. On the day they met, Congress voted, took a vote against socialism, with many Democrats joining with Republicans. Can you talk about the significance of this vote as vice chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus?
The problem with the vote is that there is a group of people like Zoran who call themselves democratic socialists. I call myself a progressive capitalist, but democratic socialism does not mean that you're going to seize the means of production. What they're talking about is taxing billionaires more, which I agree with, and having things like Medicare for All, free public college. And in providing resolutions that are condemning that, what they are doing is condemning a part of a coalition that wants to tackle income inequality and hold wealth more accountable.
And this affordability agenda, it's a real challenge to Republicans, to President Trump himself, but it's also a challenge to many Democrats. For example, the leader, the Democratic leader of the Senate, Chuck Schumer, who never endorsed Zoran Mamdani. What is your message to Democrats across the country as a former head of the campaign of Bernie Sanders, who very much endorses Mamdani?
Well, my message to Chuck Schumer was step down as minority leader. You're out of touch with the Democratic base. But my broader message is you cannot have a group of elites who are piling up wealth. In my district in Silicon Valley, $18 trillion of wealth. Amy, one-third of the entire national stock market is in my district. We need to tax billionaires. We need to tax that wealth. We need to have Medicare for all. We need to have $10 a day childcare. We need to stop Wall Street from buying single-family homes. We need a living wage. We need free public college and free trade schools. We need a Marshall Plan for America's economic development. It's not just about mouthing the words affordability. It's about changing an economic system that has accumulated wealth in the hands of a few and abandoned working in middle-class Americans across this country. I believe that we need an FDR-like, bold, progressive economic agenda. I call it new economic patriotism. But people like Zoran, people like Bernie Sanders, others, Greg Kazar, Pramila Jayapal, many of us are working towards that for a Democratic Party that is actually going to live up to those ideals.
Mm. And finally, President Trump renaming Trump Kennedy Center for the Arts. The sign has already gone up. I thought it was the Congress who named the Kennedy Center.
It is the Congress. I mean, he is violating the congressional law, but that hasn't stopped him. But I think finally people are catching on that Donald Trump is just acting all about himself. It's about his name on things. It's about his family making money. It's about his ego, and it's not about the American people. And my belief is after Trump, we're actually going to want leaders who put the people first, who maybe aren't showmen, aren't bombastic, aren't all about themselves, but are listeners, more humility. One of the great presidents in my lifetime was Jimmy Carter. I got to intern for him at the Carter Center. And I think his model of being a servant leader, humility, morality. My hope is that the country will go back to those kind of leaders across the country.
Ro Khanna, I want to thank you for being with us. A Democratic Congress member from California, co-authored the Epstein Files Transparency Act, vice chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. Coming up, Israel's approved 19 new settlements in the occupied West Bank. We'll go to Ramallah. Stay with us.
Said you're gonna shoot me down, put my body in the river. Shoot me down, put my body in the river. And the whole world sings. Sing it like a song. The whole world sings like there's nothing going wrong. He shot her down, he put her body in the river. He covered offered her up, but I went to get her and I said, my girl, what happened to you now? I said, my girl, we gotta stop it somehow.
Body Electric, performed by Linda Segarra in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's cabinets approved a proposal for the construction of 19 new Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank, a move that violates international law and further threatens the possibility of creating a Palestinian state. Far-right Israeli Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich has led Israel's illegal settlement expansion campaign. There's been a sharp rise of illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank under Israel's current far-right government, with the latest approval bringing the total number of settlements to at least 210, compared to 141 in 2022, according to the settlement watchdog group Peace Now. This comes as deadly Israeli raids and settler attacks continue across the West Bank. Palestinian officials reported Saturday Israeli soldiers shot dead a 16-year-old teenager during a raid in Jenin. Israeli forces shot Dayan Mohammed Abdul Qadir Abu Muala at point-blank range. This is his mother.
The Israeli soldier executed my son from point zero. There were snipers who want to kill anyone they see. Not only my son, but anyone appears in their face. They could have shot him in the leg. My son didn't throw anything towards them. The occupation created a fake story that my son threw a stone at them. My son didn't throw a stone. And there is a video showing what happened. They took his body. I demand as a mother of a martyr whose body is being held by the army. And in the name of all the mothers, we need the bodies back. I want to bury my son in dignity.
Israeli forces reportedly blocked medical emergency workers from reaching Qadir Abu Muala, who bled to death. In a separate Israeli raid, 22-year-old Ahmed Zayoud was killed in Jenin. Meanwhile, Al Jazeera reports Israeli soldiers Monday carried out massive demolitions in East Jerusalem, destroying a residential building with bulldozers as soldiers fired stun grenades and tear gas at Palestinian residents. For more, we go to Ramallah, where we're joined by Boudou Hassan, Amnesty International researcher on Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories. Thanks so much for being with us, Boudou. If you can start off by talking about the Israeli government approving these 19 West Bank settlements, more settlements to build.
Thank you for having me. So yes, these 19 settlements that were approved yesterday can be divided into three types. First of all, already existing outposts that are even illegal according to Israeli law that were retroactively approved. The second type is neighborhoods inside settlements that were approved as independent settlements and altogether new settlements that were approved. Just in May, also 22 settlements had already been approved by the Israeli government, which only entrenches the apartheid system we're seeing in the West Bank and is showing how intricately related the relationship between settler, state-backed settler violence and Israeli policies to grab more Palestinian land, to forcibly transfer Palestinians, and to cement the presence of illegal settlements. Obviously, all settlements are illegal under international law. They are all war crimes. But to see how Israel even retroactively legalizes settlements or outposts that were even illegal according to its own laws just shows this really huge relationship between what Israeli settlers are doing on the ground and what Israeli policymakers are putting in law and practice.
Explain the difference between a settlement and an outpost, Boudou.
So an outpost are a series of structures that are placed by settlers, supposedly without the agreement of Israeli authorities, even in violations of Israel's illegal and discriminatory planning laws in the occupied West Bank, while settlements are structures that or establishments that receive the authorization of the Israeli authorities. Of course, this distinction is really arbitrary because even the outposts receive the support of the Israeli military. They are quickly equipped with electricity, with running water. Roads are paved to facilitate reaching these outposts. They enjoy full security and military support from the Israeli military. Outposts are also used as a direct way to make Palestinians' life unbearable in the occupied West Bank, especially in communities across the Jordan Valley, the South Hebron Hills, and across Area C, where it's been increasingly difficult for Palestinians to graze and to farm their lands.
Can you explain what the disengagement law is?
So the disengagement law was passed by Israel in 2005, and according to which Israel unilaterally withdrew from the Gaza Strip and removed settlements, at least four settlements existing in the occupied West Bank in the Jenin area. This law was initially cancelled, repealed by the Israeli, after a decision by the Israeli government, and it was amended so that the four settlements in the Jenin area have been approved again. So earlier this year, we've seen the approval for the construction of two of these settlements, and now we're seeing the two, Kadim and Ganim, the two settlements near the Jenin area, being approved again. And we cannot look at this approval of this settlement in separation of the policy that Israel is conducting in the northern West Bank, especially in Jenin refugee camps, in Tul Karim refugee camp, and in Nur Shams refugee camp, where Israel's mass systematic destruction of Palestinian homes and the mass forcible transfer of Palestinians, prohibiting Palestinian refugees from returning to their land, goes hand in hand with the policies and the approval of these four settlements.
Can you talk about the raids? We just went through the people who have been killed by Israel just in the last week in the occupied West Bank, and then we'll ask you about Gaza.
So as we see, killings, unlawful killings of Palestinians in the West Bank continue, as do demolitions in Silwan in occupied East Jerusalem. And as we see that these all are part and parcel of the same policy, which is again making Palestinian life unbearable, which is entrenching Israel's unlawful occupation in violation of the International Court of Justice's advisory opinion. And maybe I just would like to explain to our viewers, Amy, how the system works. For example, last year in 2024, Israel approved the construction of an outpost, or transformed an outpost called Eviatar into a settlement. Now, that outpost was built by Israeli settlers in 2021, and it was built as a so-called revenge outpost in the area of Beta. Palestinians in Beta launched weekly and at the beginning daily protests against that outpost. After that, Israel came, designated the area as state land. And after the designation of the area as state land, Israel approved the construction of this settlement called Eviatar. So this is one way how Israel uses settler violence, uses its military raids, uses its arbitrary and discriminatory orders, including designation of land as state land, in order to cement and expand these settlements across the West Bank.
Finally, Aboudour, I wanted to ask you about Amnesty International's report titled Utterly Preventable Gaza. As a flood tragedy must mobilize global action to end Israel's genocide, unquote. At least 14 Palestinians were recently killed as winter storms battered Gaza, including at least two babies who died due to the cold. Respond to what's happening in Gaza right now, even as there is a so-called truce.
Unfortunately, Amy, even though the relentless bombardment has mercifully stopped, Palestinians in Gaza continue to be killed. 402 Palestinians have been killed since the declaration of the ceasefire, including 148 children. And Israel continues its genocide. Israeli authorities continue to deliberately inflict on Palestinians in Gaza conditions calculated to bring about their physical destruction. They continue to prevent the entry of shelter supplies despite the rainy weather. They continue to prevent Palestinians from returning to their lands east of the yellow line, line, which occupies more than 50% of the total area of the Gaza Strip, and whose boundaries continue to be shifting all the time. They continue to prevent the entry of vital medical aid. And what we are seeing now with the weather, with homes collapsing on their residents, with people dying after homes are collapsing, is not simply a byproduct of the war. It's a foreseen consequence of Israel policies to prevent the entry of shelter supplies. Amy, one of the families we've talked to, the Nassar family in Sheikh Radwan, the father of the family told us, Muhammad, told us that he's done everything to protect his family for 2 years, including being displaced over and over again. And in October, when he came back to his home in Sheikh Radwan, even though the home was dilapidated and in no condition to live in, but he had nowhere else to go, he thought that at least he protected his family, only for his two children, Lina and Ghazi, to be killed on the 12th of December after their home had collapsed on them. And all the effort that he made in order to protect his family went in vain. And this is one of so many stories of Palestinians who physically survived the genocide, only to still be suffering from this ongoing genocide, from the conditions, from the fact that for some reason the world has forgotten about Gaza.
Budur Hassan, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Amnesty International researcher on Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories, speaking to us from Ramallah. Coming up, climate scientist Michael Mann on the Trump administration's dismantling of NCAR. Stay with us.
Is there a soul left in the world that knows the way I feel tonight? Is there a book I'd never trade that shows me wrong from right? Is there a place we'll all be healed where some kind of justice gets revealed, and the least among us get to walk out from the night?
Ooh. Nowhere Bound by Stephen Michael Gooding. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. In Colorado, hundreds of protesters gathered in Boulder Saturday to condemn the Trump administration's plan to dismantle the National Center for Atmospheric Research, NCAR, a federally funded climate and weather research institute based in Boulder. Last week, White House Budget Director Russell Vogt called NCAR one of the largest sources of climate alarmism in the country, unquote. Democratic lawmakers have suggested Trump targeted the climate facility in retaliation for Colorado's refusal to release Tina Peters, a former county clerk convicted of tampering with voting machines during the 2020 presidential election. She was sentenced to 9 years. Trump recently pardoned her, but he doesn't have the legal authority to overturn a state court conviction. We're joined now by climate scientist Michael Mann, professor at the University of Pennsylvania. His new book with Dr. Peter Hotez is titled Science Under Siege. He has a new piece out today in The Guardian on Trump's shuttering of the National Center for Atmospheric Research. Can you talk about the significance, Michael, Professor Mann, of the closing? Are they closing this facility? What it means? I mean, even right now, as Colorado is under a wildfire alert because there has been so little rain and the winds are so intense.
Yeah, it's good to be with you, Amy. Unfortunately, this does sort of underscore just how absurd this latest action by the Trump administration is. We're literally seeing the devastating consequences of climate change play out in this state. You're not supposed to get wildfires in the middle of the winter in Colorado, but that's the world we live in now because of the warming of the planet and the more extreme weather that we're seeing as a result. And, you know, I think there are a lot of things that Donald Trump could have tried to do to hurt the state of Colorado. I think the reason that he chose NCAR is that it is the crown jewel of climate science for more than a half century. It has been a leader when it comes to American advancement in the science of climate modeling. And he is executing the playbook of Project 2025, the Heritage Foundation, of course, playing a major part in this dismantling of climate infrastructure. The infrastructure for doing climate science, the infrastructure for doing something about the climate crisis. So it isn't a coincidence that he's going after this, iconic climate institution.
So talk about overall the Trump administration now when it comes to climate change. And what does it mean to take NCAR basically offline? And what happens to this facility in Boulder right now?
Yeah, it's unclear at this point, and this will play out in the courts almost certainly. So we don't know the full consequences of this yet. But the models that NCAR creates are used around the world. They're among the leading models of Earth's climate system. I have benefited tremendously in my own research from the work that NCAR does when it comes to climate modeling, when it comes to observational climate data sets that allow us to document the changes that are taking place. So this will hurt climate science, certainly writ large, but it will also ensure that the United States fall to the back of the line, essentially. We used to lead in all areas of science, and certainly in climate science, and now what we're these sorts of actions are going to mean that the rest of the world moves ahead of us. Scientists are going to leave the United States for opportunities in other countries. And we are going to, essentially fall behind in terms of our scientific leadership and our scientific stature in the world. But the actual practical consequences are that we will not have the sorts of observational data and climate models that we need to inform climate policy, to help us understand what sorts of adaptive measures will need to be changed to protect people from the devastating consequences of climate change as it continues on.
The Trump administration recently denied Colorado Governor Jared Polis's disaster declaration requests for major wildfires and flooding across Colorado. The Boulder area experienced hurricane-force winds of nearly 100 miles per hour over the weekend and increased fire danger, prompting NCAR to close for safety reasons. The significance of this.
Yeah, I mean, it's ironic, isn't it? Not only are they trying, is Trump and, the Koch brothers and the other sort of plutocrats behind these actions, not only are they trying to dismantle climate science, they're trying to dismantle our ability to protect people from the devastating consequences of climate change. So it's cruel. It's going to cost lives. I mean, these actions it may be a little bit more subtle than the lives cost because of their anti-science actions when it comes to vaccines and COVID-19 and protecting, protecting public health in that arena. But millions of people ultimately will die from the consequences of extreme weather events, coastal inundation, all of these impacts that are made worse by the warming of the planet that's due to the burning of fossil fuels, the burning of fossil fuels by the very companies and plutocrats and petrostates that are behind the policies of this administration.
Said, not since the ransacking of the Library of Alexandria have we witnessed such a wanton, intentional assault on scientific knowledge. We have 30 seconds, Professor Mann.
Yeah, it's a line from my commentary, and there's some question as to the veracity of that story, but I think it captures sort of the insanity of what we're doing. We're literally destroying knowledge, and we have to look back to ancient times to see eras similar. When barbarians tried to destroy knowledge, that's what this administration is doing. They're trying to destroy knowledge.
Michael Mann, professor at the University of Pennsylvania, co-author of the book Science Under Siege with Dr. Pete Hotez. We will link to your new piece out today in The Guardian. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for our video news production and digital fellowship programs. You can learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Nicole Salazar, Sarah Nasser, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Ravi Karen, Hani Masood, Safwat Nazal, our executive director, Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley. I'm Amy Goodman.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting live from Burnaby Mountain, Burnaby, BC.
something curious, something cultural, something unserious, sometimes serious, something mundane, something everyday, though not even really that. Tune into Typically Tuesdays, airing every Monday. You heard that right, Monday, from 3 to 4 p.m. Your hour of quasi-cerebral talk and tunes.